Good morning.
No. All came at once.
The House Committee on Revenue will come to order. We have for our information meeting on January 21st, 2009. Paul, do you want to introduce it?
Okay. Mr. Chair, we're continuing kind of the background information on the revenue system, and we've got two major pieces today. First half of the meeting on the property tax, and Daybeck is going to be working on most of the property tax bills, doing the revenue impact analysis, so he'll go through the basic outline of the property tax system with you. And then John Phillips from the Department of Revenue is going to talk about assessment and administrative issues around the property tax, which, of course, are a major element of it. And then the second half of the meeting, we have Steve Meyer to go through the school finance system with you. Of course, a lot of that system was developed here by the revenue committees, particularly the distribution formula, and Steve will go through that with you and address any questions you have.
Good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. Daybeck, Legislative Revenue Office. I'm going to do a little presentation on property tax and difficult part John will handle. Today we're going to look at history and significance of Oregon's property tax, and we're going to review Measure 5 and Measure 15, and we'll also take a look at some statistics and trends. And as a lead-in to John's presentation, we're going to take a look at property assessment and urban renewal. As you know already, Oregon's property tax system is one of the most important sources of revenue for the public sector in Oregon. This source is supposed to raise $4.47 billion for local government in fiscal year 07-08. Only state personal income tax collections exceed property tax collections as a source of state and local revenue. Before we talk about statistics and trends, we're going to take a look at some of the useful definitions. This is taken from Oregon Constitution, Article 11, Section 11B. Real market value is the amount in cash which could be reasonably expected by an informed seller without acting without compulsion. Now, economists would like to use voluntary exchange. This is the word from the Constitution, so we're using it. Let's see, it's a value can be reasonably expected by an informed seller acting without compulsion from an informed buyer acting without compulsion in an arm's length transaction during the period for which the property is taxed. So the value that can be agreed upon by voluntary exchange. Assessed value is, in our for our purpose, value of property subject to taxation. Measure 5, the structure of property tax changed very little until the 90s, when two statewide ballot measures dramatically changed the system. Measure 5, which introduced property tax rate limits, was passed in 1990 and became effective in 91-92 tax year. When fully implemented in 95-96, Measure 5 cut property taxes at an average rate of 51% from 1991 levels. Measure 50, passed in 1997, did several things. First, cut property taxes, introduce assessed value growth limits, and replace most tax levies with permanent rates. It transformed the system from one primarily based on levies to one primarily based on rates. When implemented in 97-98, Measure 50 cut effective tax rates an average of 11% from their 96, 97 levels. To understand the statistics we're going to discuss, we need a little quick cheat on limits, Measure 5 limits. That's $5 per $1,000 real market value for schools, public school system, including community colleges. $10 per $1,000 real market value for general government taxes. And these limits apply only to operating taxes, not bonds. For each property, school taxes and general government taxes will be compared to their limits respectively. Measure 50 has set the assessed value growth limits. But first, assessed value for 97-98 was set at 90% of 95-96 assessed value for each property. And permanent rates were established using complicated formula mandated by Measure 15. Annual growth of assessed value was limited to 3% for existing property. And for new property, assessed value was calculated roughly real market value times the average value divided by real market value of similar property. So with that background, if you look at the summary of Oregon property tax values, property values and taxes, real market value in 07 and 08 was $501 billion. And total taxes imposed was $4.47 billion. For this taxes, property taxes, the assessed value that were used was $271 billion. That's net assessed value. There's a little difference between total assessed value and net assessed value. The bulk of the difference is so-called urban renewal access base value.
Excuse me just a moment. I think what you're saying is then that that base is around $9.3 billion thereabouts. No, you're just doing a little arithmetic.
Roughly speaking, about $9.3 billion was urban renewal access base value.
Right, thank you. Yeah. And please ask if you have questions. This is complex stuff. And many of us have heard this before, but I suspect a couple of you haven't, so don't be afraid to ask, please.
Can I? Sorry.
Yes, please. Go. That's a representative call.
Yeah. So the difference between the two figures, just so I get this clear, is the lower number is where the property tax has been capped, and then all of the amount above that would be the TIF that would be accruing to the urban renewal district to pay off the bonds. Is that correct? Is that how to view those numbers? So is all of that the tax increment that's occurring to the urban renewal district?
Well, there are a couple of other little items.
Okay, please.
But the bulk actually is what you said, yes.
Okay.
And that's the value, the increase in value in property in the plan area when compared to the frozen value at the beginning of urban renewal plan.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. So if you look at out of all these taxes, $4.47 billion, operating taxes was $3.6 billion, and bond taxes was about 700 million out of that was so-called gap bonds, whose principals and interests are being paid by operating taxes, not bond levies. So bond levies alone, not from permanent rates, is, we'll get to that a little bit, but it's about a little over $600 million. Out of total property taxes, urban renewal taxes was $191 million. If you look at the percent change over 07 and 08, real market value increased 15.4%, and total assessed value increased 5.7%, and net assessed value increased 5.4%. And as you are all well aware, individual properties tax growth is limited to 3% annually. That's for existing individual properties without property events. Now, total taxes actually increased 9.6% over 06-07. Total assessed value has been increasing substantially more than 3% annually. The minimum that we saw was about 3.7%. Sometimes went up to 6-7%. And when Measure 50 limited the growth on an annual basis to 3%, that applies, still applies to individual properties. But there will be new constructions and property improvements, and all these will add to assessed values. Now, a little information about operating taxes. Taxes from permanent rates actually fund the general operating budget. Measure 5 limits applies to so-called permanent rates, local option, gap bonds, pension levy, and urban renewal plan. The levies that are not subject to Measure 5 limit is bond levies for capital construction. District for property tax purpose, a local government entity that imposes property taxes, a district can include multiple taxing districts. For example, City of Salem includes taxing districts representing the portions of the city located in Marion and Polk counties. The districts are so-called K through 12, and that's schools, educational service districts, city, county, community college, and special district. And special district includes, among other things, service, port, fire, park, water control, library, transit, public and utility, public utilities. Property taxes by type of district. So we have K through 12 and education service districts. The taxes here explain 42%, and it's about 1.8%, 1.8 billion dollars out of about 4.4. Cities, 23%, counties, 19%, and special districts, 12%, and community colleges uses 4%. Property taxes by type of taxes. Permanent rate that was established under Measure 50 and gap together, gap bonds together, explains 77% of the property tax revenues. Bond, a little over $600 million. And local option is about 6% of total. And then urban renewal use is about 4% of total property taxes.
Let me ask a hypothetical question connected with this issue. Now, as I understand local option, I know how it applies to schools because I was on the school board when we were working on some of this stuff, that the difference, in effect, the difference between the taxes that can be levied under Measure 50 based on the Measure 50 limits and taxes that can be levied under Measure 5 based on 5% of real market value. Five mils of real market value. Do we have a similar rule? Does a similar rule, the local option, apply to the government portion of the tax as well as to the school portion of the tax? The gap between Measure 5 limits and Measure 50 limits?
Mr. Chair, yes.
Okay. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is John Phillips. I'm with the Oregon Department of Revenue. Thank you. I will try to answer your question. Mr. Chair, the $5 limitation imposed by Measure 5, which is Article 11, Section 11B, which they referred to, applies to both both types of local options, all local options generally, school local options and local government local options. So to the extent the Measure 5 compression limits, which are the $5 and the $10,
right,
apply to all local options.
Right.
So all local options in the education category are subject to that limit, and local options in the general government category are subject to that limit, which is the $10 limit. So if in the local government, or let's say county, city, park, library, recreation district, those kinds of districts, when there are local options in that category, and all of the taxes in that category exceed the $10 limitation, then that's when the taxes are reduced in that category. So the $10 would compress all taxes down to no more than $10 per thousand of market value.
Yeah, I was actually asking a simpler question than that, but you did answer the next question.
Okay.
Let me ask the third question then, if I may, and that is this. If every district in the state was able to pass a local option levy, how much would it raise? I know it's considerably more than the $258 million. How much would it raise? In other words, if you could actually apply the Measure 5 limits rather than the Measure 50 limits, even with compression, do you have an idea?
Mr. Chair, in terms of dollars, there is an estimate that exists. Our research department put together an estimate of the available taxes under assuming all taxing districts in all categories could levy their full amount under that limitation.
Mm-hmm.
There is an estimate out there. Paul's aware of it. I can see he's nodding his head. I don't have that number on the tip of my tongue, but I believe our research unit did an estimate of that value and provided it to the Committee on Revenue Restructuring.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, it was done specifically for those counties that were losing federal timber dollars, and
right,
so they do have an estimate. Yeah, I can't remember that either, but we'll get that to make sure.
It's in the report, isn't it?
It is for the timber-dependent counties, but I'm not sure if it is statewide,
okay,
but we can get that. Again, I would emphasize, though, if you look at individual taxpayers, remember that, as Dave said, these limits are imposed on a per-property basis,
right,
and that's what makes it very difficult to explain to voters that, right, if you have a local option, it's going to could affect individual taxpayers differently, depending on what their ratio is of their assessed value to market value. So that has been one of the complicating factors.
I remember very well that when we first were working on it in the Eugene School District, it was very difficult to make that explanation, and we didn't even know how much money that the levy would actually raise until it came in, because it is a per property calculation. So the point of my question, of course, is that, or maybe the point of the answer to me is, to some extent, counties and cities and school districts do have the capacity to raise additional funds if they can get the approval of the local voters to do it. This is not true everywhere, but it's true in most places, I think. Thank you. I'm sorry. Go ahead. Unless there are other questions.
To summarize, the type of property taxes imposed by type of district, the permanent rate plus gap bonds together, it's 3.417 billion dollars, and that the growth of it over the year was about 6.6%, and local option increased 34% from 193 million to 259 million. Bond increased 17.5% from 513 to 603. Total bonds gap and this exempt bond together is about 690, about close to 700 million. So about 90 million is gap bonds. And total district taxes increased 9.4% over the year. Urban renewal taxes increased 16%. Altogether, the property tax increased 9.6% in 07-08 over 06-07. If you look at the assessed value and real market value, and of course, there's a sort of divergence. And if you look at what had happened there, first we had Measure 5 starting in 1991-92, and Measure 5 was fully phased in 95-96. And then the first year of Measure 50 was 97 and 98 tax year. So the property taxes imposed gradually went down and went up a little, and then with the start of Measure 50 there was a decline, but then we had an increase between 3 to 7%. The latest property tax increase was about 9.6% last year. Look at closely. We have again the difference between divergence between real market value and assessed value here. Roughly, if you calculate the average tax rate based on property tax imposed and assessed value, this is total assessed value, not net assessed value. It's about over $15-16 if you look at right-hand side scale. That's about a little over $15 per $1,000 real market value. Property taxes, a share of Oregon personal income, it's a little over 3% here. And it's been quite stable in the 90s and through 2000s. Relative property tax burden, this is taken out of our basic facts book. For fiscal year 05-06, all taxes rank 34. But if you look at property taxes, about the property tax per person is about $1,000, 05-06. Latest calculation is about $1,150 per person, and ranked about 30th in the country. As a lead into John's discussion about property administration, before we talk about that, I'm going to talk a little bit about loss in property taxes or reduced assessment. Property assessment, the first starts with appraisal. Appraisal is the process of identifying and assigning a value to a property. And who does the appraisal? It's the county assessors. They do most property in Oregon. But Oregon Department of Revenue the appraisal on certain large industrial sites and utility properties. The property subject to taxation are all privately owned real property, like land, buildings, fixed machinery and equipment, manufactured home, personal property used in business. Properties not subject to taxation: household furnishings, personal belongings, automobiles, crops, orchards, business inventories, and also certain intangible properties. Some properties are exempt from assessment. Exempt properties are most property used for religious, fraternal, and government purposes. And some properties are assessed at a reduced base. They are open space, farmland, forest land, historical buildings, and also properties owned by disabled veterans. These are not exhaustive, it's just examples, yes.
Thank you. This may be a question for Paul. When ordinary taxpayers think of property taxes, of course, they think of their land and that bill they get in November. If you're a business in Oregon, you get the same bill and all your inventory and all your equipment and everything else goes with it. Is there any separation of those two in terms of how much property tax is paid on just land versus business equipment and that sort of an everything else? Is that available somewhere?
Yes, Representative Berger, we have the personal property, which has there is a limit for small business or an exempt amount. We do have that broken out in the annual property tax statistics.
So is it in the basic facts?
I don't believe it is.
You don't have to give it to me right now. If somebody would get back to me, I'd just be curious to see what that breakdown is.
Yeah, it's in that the property tax statistics volume there the Department of Revenue puts out.
And I assume that's on your website.
Yes.
No.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Yeah, Representative Bailey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a real basic question here. On the slide under property assessment, I'm having a little bit of trouble understanding the intersection between real market value and assessed value and when assessed values can change and when they can recalibrate. I know just from personal experience of knocking on doors in my district of finding folks that have wildly varying tax rates for properties that seem to have a similar market value and properties that have been around for a while. Could you talk a little bit about how and when those assessed values can change and for what reasons?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bailey, yes, I'll give that a shot. That is a separate entire hour presentation, but we'll just condense it down here to a minute. Since the changes in 1997, for all existing property, the legislature came up with a way to deal with new property. So new property is the new improvements, a new building, those kinds of things. So in those situations,
there's a formula that's developed to create a proxy rollback, because as Day said, properties in 97 were rolled back to their 95 value minus 10%. So the proxy is called the change property ratio, and that ratio creates for some people differences in their property assessed value, even though they may live next door to each other. If you have an existing home and a bare lot in 1997, today you might have a new home built on that lot, and the taxes will most likely be different. That's one of three situations that can occur to create the situation you're talking about. Another situation that was illustrated in the Oregonian some few years back demonstrated several properties, one in, like, say, West Portland, the hills, and one in maybe Northeast. And the values of the market values were low in the Northeast, let's say, and higher in the West Hills, and values have been coming up in the East. I guess this is East, I'm sorry. And so now the market values are on par, but the taxes were lower and only growing at 3% since 97. So then you've got two similarly valued properties with different taxable values. And I use the word taxable value synonymously with assessed value, and that's the constitutional term. Does that?
That's helpful. Thank
okay.
you.
Can I add something?
Yes.
Just to follow up on John's response to Vice Chair's question, the Senate Finance and Revenue Committee devoted an interim meeting to this issue, and it is coming up a lot more. And one of the panels that they invited was kind of the creators of Measure 50, former Revenue Chair, now Commissioner Tom Bryan was there, and my predecessor, Jim Scherzinger, who spent a lot of hours on Measure 50. But that was one of the trade-offs they recognized, was that this trade-off between predictability for taxpayers, that meaning their bill would go up 3% a year if they didn't change their property, versus equity. That, you know, you get a basic concept of property tax or public finance theory is that equals should be treated equally, horizontal equity. And so the system is moving away from that as market values grow faster in some areas than they do in others. And inevitably, you're going to see this come up more. And the committee did have a number of citizens who testified saying, you know, my taxes are a lot higher than my neighbors, and our homes are valued the same amount. And it really had to do the timing of when their market values changed and when it was assessed under Measure 50.
Thank you.
According to tax expenditure report published by Department of Revenue for fiscal year 2009-11, these are examples of losses, if you will, because some of the properties are fully exempt or partially exempt or specially assessed. So out of full exemption category, intangible personal property, we have potential property tax loss of a little over $12 billion, federal, state, and local property about a little over $3 billion. The list goes on, and partial exemption example is strategic investment program. It's a little over $100 million. Properties owned by disabled veterans is about $24 million. Historical property, about $20 million. Nonprofit low-income rental housing, about $12 million. And specially assessed properties, because of special assessment, the revenue loss would be about $262 million for farmland over 2 years, and private forest land is about $57 million. Property tax losses that is due to Measure 5 limit general because of Measure 5 limits, it's called compression. And compression is the process used to reduce property taxes to the Measure 5 limits.
Did you have something?
I did. I have a delayed question. I'm sorry, and I may have missed it. Did you describe exactly what intangible personal property is?
It's not the real. It's not a real physical property.
Mm-hmm.
Let's go back and can you fill in a little more?
Sure, Mr. Chair, Representative Gelser. Intangible personal property is defined in the statute as being, and I'm not going to recall every single one, but it's like bonds,
stocks, bank accounts,
generally that type of thing. It can include other things like goodwill.
Intellectual property?
Intellectual property.
Yes.
Thank you.
Things that don't have a physical reality that you can touch.
Exactly.
This is a general definition of intangible.
Yes.
I guess that's the word comes from that, doesn't it?
Yes.
Yeah.
So back to the compression issue. Compression, again, is the process used to reduce property taxes to the Measure 5 limits. $5 for schools and $10 for non-school general government. Again, for each property, school taxes and general government taxes will be compared to their limits separately, not combined. Limits apply only to operating taxes, not exempt bonds. If exceeding Measure 5 limits, compression starts in a specific order, beginning with local option taxes. Compression laws ranges widely across counties, and state total for 07-08 was $53 million, up from about $49 million year before. Just quickly on Urban Renewal Agency, we had about $191 million collected for urban renewal plan purpose. ORS Chapter 547 gives each city and county the ability to activate an urban renewal agency. So urban renewal agency has power to propose and act on plans to eliminate, remedy, prevent, conserve, rehabilitate blighted areas when approved by the city or the county. Unless otherwise stipulated, voter approval is not needed. Substantial funding comes from a so-called division of tax, that is, portions taken out of local government property taxes. For urban renewal purpose, about $160 million out of $191 million came out of division of tax revenue. The urban renewal plans adopted before December 696 may also raise revenue through urban renewal levy. It's called special levy revenue. Division of tax is calculated by splitting local government property taxes between local governments and the urban renewal agency. The split is recalculated every year based on value growth within the plan area. That's when $9.3 billion comes in. Both division of tax and urban renewal special levy are subject to general government tax limitation. That's Measure 5 limits. And this is my end of presentation, and John's going to talk about administrative side of the
Representative Berger, did you have a question or comment?
Mr. Chair, if you'd indulge me, I realized
Please.
That I did not do my job, and I need to go back to slide number 21, which is the one that had the intangible personal property on it.
Yes.
The second category under full exemption is federal, state, and local property taxes, $3.352 billion in exemption, full exemption. I live in the city of Salem, my friends, and if you look at the heart of the city of Salem, which I represent, you will find there is a huge amount of property that you overlook that does not collect any property taxes for the city of Salem, and yet the city of Salem provides fire service, EMT services, and all the services to those buildings without collecting a dime of property taxes. And I can tell you it is an issue in my district, so I would like the Revenue Committee to be aware of it. Thank you.
Thank you very much. We do appreciate those services in this building. Representative Gelser.
I would just point out that fire is never an issue in those buildings.
Right.
Yes. I'm sure the governor will be pleased to hear that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for letting me put that on the record.
Thank you very much. Representative Benz.
Mr. Chairman, going back, I think, to Representative Gelser's question about exemptions and the intangible value in the state that's not taxed, was this an attempt to itemize all of the property that we've got in this state and then say this is what is taxed and this is what is not? I mean, do we have the full gamut of property covered by our tax system?
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative Benz, the properties that are exempt or partially exempt or specially assessed, a lot of them come from federal state laws and these are legitimate. The property taxes exempted or partially exempted, and these are the calculations based on following the laws and regulations. The way we look at it is just we have no control over it, or new programs mandated by laws or can also change these values, of course.
Yes, please go ahead.
Let me use an example. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The example would be software for a computer and the license that we have to buy for it. So is that exempt?
Paul?
Yeah. I believe it would be. It's personal property.
Mr. Chair, Representative Benz, if I can back you up just a little bit, I would add to Dave's comments by saying that the property tax law assumes all property is taxable, and then only by specific exemption or alteration from that is it exempt. So that's why all these things are enumerated. Software, I have heard that there, you know, depending on whether it's business or personal, it would be taxable or not taxable, but I have heard some discussions about the types of proprietary software, for example. It gets a little bit technical and gray because if a company is using a software that's owned by someone else and they're using it, then there's issues there about whose property is it. So the software depends on the ownership and the use.
Representative Benz.
Thank you again, Mr. Chairman. It seems to me that we're moving out of a lot of older types of property systems and into much more interesting systems. And I'm just wondering if our tax policy is keeping up. And I'm wondering if there isn't enormous value caught up in a lot of these systems that, for whatever reason, maybe the complexity of it makes us hesitant to look at it as a source of revenue. Would that be a correct thought, or is it simply that it's not really here in Oregon and therefore we're not taxing it?
Mr. Chair, Representative Benz, I think your choice of the word interesting is very good.
Well, remember, lawyers use the word interesting when they mean complex and unsettled.
Yes, and Mr. Chair, that is exactly what we've been struggling with over the years, is to try to keep up with all the changes in technology and property as it's being redefined. And you will see at least one bill this session that we're bringing forward to sort of update and modernize some of the property tax statutes because of the very fact that, while it's not as interesting as intellectual property, the telegraph is still subject to taxation, and that's probably something that could be updated.
Of course, you can tax the wires and the poles. I think Representative Benz is referring to something slightly different from
Correct.
That.
Yes.
Please.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. My thought is this: we seem to be moving into an intellectual arena, and in fact, our entire educational system is prompted toward things other than manufacturing, more on an intellectual bent. I'm just wondering if our tax system is designed to keep up with that change, or what our revenue department, is doing to make sure that this type of value, which appears to be growing in Oregon, is indeed paying its fair share of the freight.
Mr. Chair, Representative Vance, I would like to do some research on that and come back to you with maybe an answer. And I can tell you that for larger companies that are centrally assessed, and we'll talk more about what that is, and maybe you're familiar with that already, but the company is appraised and valued as an entire unit, including all of its intellectual property and content of its the types of content that pass through these lines and cables. And but for other types of property, to the extent it's intangible and it's not centrally assessed, then it's probably not being that it's not being taxed.
Thank you.
Can I?
Yes, Representative Carl.
And just to probe a bit more deeply on this, thank you, Mr. Chair. I would love to, when you're following up with Representative Vance, to also, I'm wondering, as we move into this new property world, how much tax is actually being deferred to a later time. So under more traditional models, you have a realizing event with stocks, bonds, whatever, and then we get the tax later on down the road. And I'm wondering, in this new interesting world, how much income that might have been realized today is actually being shifted further down the road, and we're just shifting the point in time in which we would be receiving the taxes. Does that make sense?
Mr. Chair, Representative Call, I'm not sure I understand exactly
Maybe the, maybe Representative Vince can help me with that thought.
Well, would the shift that you're describing take place in the property tax realm? I think what the example you used, I think, is an income tax example.
Right, but when we're talking about intangible property, I'm wondering if we get the taxes at some point. It's not a matter of them disappearing from the system altogether, but rather they're showing up at a different point in the system, at a different time, and that time frame is further down the road. That's what I'm wondering, if we can look at the property in a different way. Does that make sense? Yes.
Yes, Representative
Vance. Chairman, Cole, I think that's a good point, and I had thought about asking the question slightly differently, to kind of an overview of when we tax each item, but I think that the correct me if I'm incorrect here, but if you have a farm, you pay property tax every year and you get to pay again when you sell it. So the issue then is the item that we're debating one of inventory, which is constantly rotating, and thus we get to capture that value when it's sold, or is it something that's held for making money and thus it's taxed while you own it? And so one way, I think that's what your question is.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Much better phrase than I did it.
Well,
thank you.
Well, anyway, the issue, it seems to me, is whether our department is appropriately identifying these assets that are held for generating income, and are we then subjecting those folks that own those assets to the same burdens that go with the older types of property we enjoy in this state? That's the question.
Mr. Chair, Representative Vance, those are challenging questions, and I think I would like to get together with you maybe at your convenience and talk through how best to answer those questions.
I think I hear the work group beginning to form. Yes. Why don't you go ahead with your presentation, and we'll mull this interesting concept.
Okay.
Interesting.
Thank you very much. Thank you for inviting me to talk a little bit today about the property tax administration. And so I've kind of would like to cover a few things about how it's organized, the structure, the department's role in providing grants to work with counties in the assessment of property, and whose responsibilities and how are they divided, and finally to identify sort of outcomes from the system. Just briefly, the Oregon tax for property was established in 1844, so prior to statehood. And as Dave mentioned, it's the second largest tax. You already know that it funds what it funds, and that we have oversight responsibility. And I am remiss. I do not have handouts, so I'm sorry if you're looking for them.
I can't read that.
Yeah. Our copier was down this morning, and I did not have a contingency plan.
Yes.
Because I can't read that, and that's crooked, and so I always read what's in front of me. As you're speaking, John, will you please be sure and get this up to my office afterwards?
Thank you. Sorry. That would be good. I'm pleased to hear we're not overpaying for copying services in the Department of Revenue.
Well, at least not this morning. Okay. For the outline for today, I just wanted to talk about the tax administration, how it's administered. Jointly between the counties and the Department of Revenue, and property tax administration, what? That's not a real catchy what, but it's kind of what is the substance of what we do and how it works through the taxes and the tax expenditure being the total sum of the effort. And then I just wanted to highlight and illustrate a couple of administrative issues, including your interaction this session with the property tax. So back to the how part of the presentation. I was just going to use a tree metaphor. I've used this one other time to sort of give an idea of how we interact, and the system is like a tree where the roots are part of the support process that we use to support the system, nourishing it. The trunk provides some backbone. We've got branches delivering to the leaves, who at which point provide healthy, more educated, and safer Oregonians. And that's an illustration of what I just mentioned. And I'll talk about just briefly each one of these as we go. So for the Department of Revenue provides some support for the system in forms of what I'm referring to as the roots through continuing education for county appraisers and county staff and our own staff. Professional appraisal qualifications are required by statute, so we provide classes to keep appraisers in the counties updated on their professional qualifications. We provide supportive roles for, like, say, the deferral program. You're familiar with the Senior Property Tax Deferral Program. There are appeals. The system that appraisal is used is called mass appraisal. So we don't go out like someone that's valuing your home for a bank loan, let's say, and just value your home, measure each corner. But every year, all million-plus properties are appraised in a mass appraisal program. And we provide assistance with that. Subject area experts are people like the 123 exemption programs. We have a person that works with that. The Oregon local budget law, timber and forest land taxation, and many others. We work with counties on a system you created in 1989 called the County Assessment Function Funding Account, and you can see why we have an acronym for that. And it creates some monies that help counties afford to pay for this administration system. So your counties that you represent provide us the lion's share of the revenue to pay for assessment and collection functions that go to all local governments, but this is a little seed money to help them pay for part of that cost through document recording and interest on delinquent taxes. It's a grant program that every year each county applies for, and they have to meet certain minimum standards in order to get the grant. The grant right now supplies about $39 million for counties, and the forecast is that that will be going down because for reasons such as document recording fees are going down because people are not recording documents right now. So it makes up, I'm going to say, around 23% of the total costs. back to the metaphor, the trunk in the department, we have a mapping section. We call it cadastral, and in that mapping section, we produce and review maps for all the counties you can imagine. I know Salem had in excess of 20 annexation measures on the November ballot, and so each one of those annexations has to be processed, and all of the tax lot maps change so that everybody knows who's now in the city is paying city taxes. Appeals of property value are handled on several levels by the department, and we also appraise certain industrial and all unitary properties. By unitary, I mean synonymous with centrally assessed. So these are those generally regulated companies or transportation, communications, rail, gas, electric, those kinds of companies. For the mapping function, everything is geographically referenced. You know, your property boundaries are very important to you, and things change, like riverbeds change, tax lot information, the annexations I mentioned. People tend to buy and sell property. So every day, the tax lot maps have to be are changed, and then just keeping up with that is a large job. There's about 45,000 maps with 1.7 tax lots, so we're busy doing that. We actually contract with 14 counties to do all their mapping functions. So they're paying us to do the mapping function for all of those changes. And then we provide assistance with a statewide base map system.
Representative Vance?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The LIDAR system, are you familiar with the LIDAR system of mapping?
Mr. Chair, Representative Benz, I sat in on a presentation of one, and I know our geographic cadastral folks are aware of that. I'm not sure to what extent we're using it.
Follow-up. I use your ORMAP system all the time, and it is excellent. It is a wonderful system. But it struck me as I was watching the presentations on LIDAR that LIDAR system is astoundingly accurate. And for those of you who don't know, it's a laser system. When the airplane flies over and does a triangle, right, and gives you within 2 inches the size of the height of the trees and the height of the cars and the height of the people walking across the ground and the depth of the ditches and the ditch. It's an astounding device. But if you could incorporate it with that, the I don't know how many assessors it would put out of business, but it most assuredly gives you a snapshot that is astounding, and the values are just starting to be understood because it's so different. Anyway, I just want to make sure you guys were aware of it, and you are. So, that's
Mr. Chair, Representative Vance, yes, exactly, and that's the kind of technology we're having. You know, we want to be moving toward right. For accuracy.
Right. When you say 14 counties are using your services for mapping, do those tend to be urban counties or rural counties or? Which counties are doing that? Or is it a mix?
Mr. Chair, I really don't know which 14 counties.
That's fine. Thank you.
I would suggest maybe that they're rural, but I couldn't say with certainty.
Yeah. Thanks.
And thank you for creating ORMAP. That's been a tremendous asset, and it will become. We're in goal 2 or 3 of a 4 or 5 goal process, so counties come on, that's... This is an example of one of the maps that we're moving from the old paper system to the digital, and this is a subdivision in which a previous Revenue Committee chair used lives. He will remain unnamed.
Okay.
Chosen at random.
Who will see him soon? Yeah.
Trunk. The trunk provides an appraisal function from the department. As I said, we appraise all unitary or centrally assessed properties and large industrial properties. So anything over $1 million for industrial, so those kind of transition between the counties and the department depending on the value of the company. And the counties appraise residential, commercial, and small industrials. For appeals, there are different avenues of appeals for taxpayers. The BOPTA is what we call the Local Board of Property Tax Appeals. And for 2007-08, there were 4,260 appeals. This is down significantly from before 1997, when actual taxable value was triggered off your market value. Since taxable value is not market value for most properties anymore, the appeals are way down. And as Dave talked about, and as you know, the real estate market properties values are dropping, and people are appealing. We had just talking to the Deschutes County Assessor last week, and he said they have 1,000 appeals for the board appeals this year. So that's one quarter of last year's total appeals. The Department of Revenue has two different kinds of appeals. One for centrally assessed companies is called the Director's Review. It's kind of similar to the local board, only for those companies. And then we have supervisory, where an error has occurred in unique circumstances, and we get a chance to see if it's possible to fix errors. And there's also the next step would be the tax court. Taxpayers could go to the magistrate, which is a kind of an informal process. And then to the regular division, there's one tax court judge, Judge Breithop, and then after that, the appeal is directly to the Supreme Court. We don't have very many of those.
Well, the tax court judge handles other tax appeals in addition to property tax appeals.
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Yes, I'm glad to hear that.
Income taxes.
Yeah, 6 cases a year would not be a full load.
He yes. And he also volunteers, I think, in various other counties.
As a circuit court judge?
Yes.
Thank you.
The branches are areas of county functions, and, of course, they calculate the taxes. And I'll talk just briefly about that later on. They collect all the taxes, they distribute the taxes, and they maintain all the records in the customer services at your county office. The leads, of course, are, and I broke this down into two parts, they're taxing districts, as Dave talked about, cities, counties, schools and special districts receive the benefits of these. There are no direct state property taxes sent to the general fund. I was going to do a section on property tax myths, and that was one of them, because a lot of people think there's a state property tax. But a myths section would take a full 4 hours, so we'll skip that part. And then other policy objectives are objectives that you as a legislature decided you wanted to do as through tax expenditures. These are the exemptions and the special assessments that Dave was mentioning. And they focus on areas like economic development, natural resources, and social programs. Here's just a little pie of the $7.5 billion. This includes all of the actual tax revenue and the tax that's not collected, due to the fact that there are public lands that are not taxed, federal, state, local, and then the other tax expenditures like Day mentioned, for example, that disabled war veterans homes are partially exempt and enterprise zones, those kinds of things. The exempt public lands are forest parks, public buildings like this building. Education are the traditional educational entities that receive property tax.
Does that include the campus across the street? Even though it's not a public school, it's a private school.
Mr. Chair, I believe that is, because it's a private school, I believe it is subject to taxation.
Well, of course, it is a nonprofit corporation, I'm sure.
But I don't believe that it. I can check on that, but I don't believe.
I frankly would be astounded if they were paying property taxes.
Okay, I'll check on that.
Not because of this category.
It would have to qualify under one of the 123 programs, one of which would be it's not public property.
Right.
So it would have to be religious, charitable, literary, etc. So I would have to look.
That would be if I'm wrong, I want to know. But I would be astounded to discover that they're paying property taxes.
But the point of this slide is that they are not receiving property tax dollars.
Correct. Oh yes.
So
I'm sorry. This is the where the money is going.
Yes.
I missed that point altogether. Thank you.
And on the property tax pie, the local government services, these are county, cities, and special districts for 07, 08, $2.325 billion in revenue. And I don't expect you to read this. It's just a summary of some of the taxing districts that get property tax dollars. There are a lot more. Tax expenditures, $1.65 billion, and these are some of those areas that you make decisions on each session. And some of those involve economic incentives, urban renewal is one of them, vertical housing, strategic investment, the Day mentioned, enterprise zones, conservation easement was a bill passed last session. Historic property, you'll probably see a bill on that this session. Education and social goals, like religious organizations and low-income housing. And that's the top of the tree. And the last part is regarding what it is about the properties tax system that we do, including the values, tax rates, billings, collections, and expenditure programs, just in a little more depth. The number of accounts are just quickly 2 million accounts. Market value of a lot of market value. $271 billion in total taxable value. And Dave covered some of this, so I'll go over it quickly. But there are 1,192 taxing districts. And code areas I mentioned because each property is in a code area, and not all properties are taxed the same because of the districts that are overlapping. So each unique overlap, where all the properties in this little code area are taxed the same, there's a lot of nuances. 3,523 of them, to be exact.
Representative Vance.
This is just a remark. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. But so that total market value number is half a trillion. So the stimulus package is just twice what Oregon's total market value is worth.
That's what it sounds like.
Dave, would you like to answer that?
Something up software.
Okay.
Yeah. Right.
And total taxes imposed, $4 billion.
Please ask Microsoft what they think that's worth.
And I throw this in because this is just as important of a figure because the collected taxes in any given year is about, but by the end of the first year that they're due, the tax collectors have collected about 99% of the outstanding taxes. Existing values are set, and we'll just flip to values here, are set by the Constitution. Rates are set by the Constitution for the most part. There's always little exceptions to these, but new values are set by the Constitution. That's that changed property ratio I mentioned, the CPR. And payments and collections are statutory. So just to kind of give you a context of where some of these things are, the income tax is a little different. You can change the rate. You can change this. You can change that. Much point of this slide is much of the property tax is in the Constitution. I'm talking about values briefly, and I capitalize the value in real market value, and I've not capitalized it in anywhere else because, in my mind, the only real value is the market value. The other values, like assessed value, is just a number that was picked, and it grows by a percentage. So you've got a maximum assessed value. This is the term for the rolled back value. The lesser of the first two bullets are equal to the third bullet. So in any account, the assessed value is always the lesser of the top two. And they're specially assessed for farm and forest, maximum assessed value of specially assessed, and then it gets more complicated, and I won't go into it. But that's just the beginning of a discussion on value. Tax rates, Dave covered these pretty well. The math is really simple. Tax rate times value equals tax. Unless there's a few other variations to that. And I'll talk briefly about some variations, but the changed property ratio that Representative Bailey asked about earlier, basically, we already had this conversation, so it's a proxy. It deals with new property, and the formula is there, market value times the average. You build a house, and the assessor determines a market value for that house, And then the assessor has to determine the maximum assessed value for that house. And they do that by looking at the average market to maximum assess for all similar type properties. So if it's residential, it's what's the market value of all residential in the county compared to the maximum assessed value of all residential in the county, and you get a ratio. And it was in the 70 range when we started in 97, and it's now in the 50 range in some places. So the ratio of a new home coming on in, like, say, Clackamas County might come on at 50% of its market value. A new home in another county might come on at 60% or 40%. Just depends on what that ratio is. Some counties have vastly appreciating market values. Curry County has some depreciating values. We're seeing depreciating values these days. I already mentioned tax collections. So first year, and it depends on the county and it depends on the year, but we're right up in there, 98-99%. The property tax collection statutes in Chapter 311 are designed to be take a lot of time before the counties take someone's property. They're designed to fully collect all the taxes before that draconian event occurs. So the last percentage point or two could take up to 4 or 5 years. But eventually it's all collected. The only real problems come, you know, how 90% of the work has been on 10% of the property collection, and that's true for this too. Personal property collections, you can't foreclose on personal property. It can just leave the state or move. They'd spend a lot of time on refunds from, let's say, appeals, or they spend time on roll corrections for various reasons. Mistakes occur. Property tax variations for expenditures. This is where the property tax gets complicated too, because there are various kinds of tax expenditures. There's partial exemptions, like for the veterans, disabled veterans. Full exemptions for, like, public buildings, special assessments we've talked about for farm or forest. There's value freezes for historic property, deferred taxes, foreclosure delay for certain seniors. There's temporary exemptions, like 3 years for enterprise zones, 5 years for enterprise zones, 12 years for rotated hybrid poplars, 15 years for historic property. And then there's use variations. Just want to let you know that's not an exhaustive list. These are some of the tests that you look at when you decide to design or modify or change a tax expenditure. Sometimes they're means tested, sometimes they're not. Sometimes it's based on age, sometimes they're not. Corporate status, are they nonprofit, are they for profit? Are they an LLC? They're specific use tested, employment level tested, investment, hiring. Sometimes local governments can opt out of a tax expenditure, sometimes they can't. And sometimes the values are divided between properties, and some of the value on a property is given to one entity and some of the value is given to another. So these are some of the permutations. As you see bills this session dealing with property tax expenditures, these things might come up. Some of the concerns for tax administration, and the counties would probably add more bullets to this, but I just came up with a couple. Anything that requires hand processing is very difficult for counties in particular. Or where you create small benefits in a complex process. And the goal, of course, is to try to get fairness and uniformity. But the more you move to fairness and uniformity, sometimes the more complex it can get. New types of benefit calculations, something that was not on the list already, something new, a new way to do it. Or frequent changes to the same program. So these provide some challenges to administration. I did want to mention this, and this came out in the discussions Paul mentioned earlier, where several of the people that were involved with Measure 50, and I'll just call it pre-97, emphasized the point that pre-97, the tax system was had relatively high uniformity for taxpayers. Everybody was taxed on their market value. The sufficiency of the tax for local governments, I just put as medium. And the predictability for taxpayers was really low because 1 year your market value would go up 20%, and you didn't know how much tax you were going to pay until you got your tax bill, and then you were shocked. And this is part of the reason why the taxpayers passed Measure 47 in 1996.
But there's another issue, isn't there? I know we're running out of time, but I think we really have to say this, too. Before Measure 5 was adopted, our system was based on tax bases plus bonds that had to be paid. And so the changes in assessed value didn't affect taxation market value, except to the extent that market value changes were different in different parts of the same taxing district. If your appraised value uniformly went up, your millage rate went down, and you paid about the same number of dollars in taxes. So Measure 47 and 50 were really a fix to the error, the unpredictability built into the system by Measure 5. We had a system of taxation before Measure 5 that worked, that was predictable, and that the taxpayers actually controlled by determining whether or not they were going to allow for an increase in the tax base, whether they were going to allow for a special levy, or whether they were going to allow for a bond. So Measure 50 only replaced the predictability with a new predictability in a much more draconian system. I recognize that's a biased statement, but it's what I believe happened to the tax system when we passed these two initiatives. Anyway, that's my editorial comment.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Yes, Mr. Chair. Okay. There are concerns about uniformity, and many people consider the uniformity as being low and headed lower, and for the reasons that we had the discussion, Representative Bailey, is the change to property ratio. And then sufficiency, that's a bit of an evaluation too, but that's what's come out in the discussions since then. And I'll just point out, just in closing, that the Governor's Task Force findings I noted had 5 of the 10 findings were concerns for the property tax in the areas of uniformity for taxpayers, of sufficiency for local governments, and for administration to accommodate the various layers and the tax expenditure programs. So just to wrap up, I think that the significant issues for the property tax are those three things, and for administration, and be happy to answer any other questions you might have.
Thank you very much. Other questions, comments? Thank you. We appreciate the tutorial, and I'd like to move on to K-12 school finance.
And while Steve, still my beating heart.
Sorry? Representative
Berger? I said, be still my beating heart.
Yes. This is one of those few places where the Revenue Committee actually gets involved in determining the allocation of expenditures. So it's an interesting historical anomaly, but one that we hang on to with great care.
Not the level, but the distribution
of it. Steve?
Mr. Chair, for the record, Steve Meyer, Legislative Revenue Office. The topic is school finance, and note that I didn't use the word tax in that. Not that I really talk about taxes, but I will use the term a few times. Time is limited. there's more slides here than I intended to get through, even with more time. But we'll try and hit the highlights. What we really want to talk about this morning is where revenue sources for schools come from and how it's allocated through the state school equalization formula. And to try to give you a better understanding so that you know why your school district may get more or less dollars per student than your neighboring school district. And as a side effect, the more you know about it, the fewer questions you're going to ask me and make my job easier in that process. It's a big system. It's over 550,000 students, employs over 60,000 teachers and staff, about 1,300 school sites, and it's operated in 197 school districts by local school district boards and superintendents. So just a big overview of what all is involved, what gets funded. We basically have three levels of equity we're going to talk about between all school districts and all ESDs, two separate groups, and then for all of the school districts between the 197 individual school districts and for all ESDs between the 20 that now exist. We start out with the state school fund appropriation in terms of how much is in there. There is certain dollars that are taken what I call off of the top of the state school fund for various uses, and I have a list of those. What remains after that is the a balance available for school districts and for ESDs.
I had a question on the off-the-top special uses.
Yes.
Is that where the School for the Blind and the School for the Deaf comes out of?
Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, yes. Yeah. State special education uses.
Great. And may I ask
Representative
Gelser.
It's an honor to be. Last week I was Representative Belizio, and so I'm passing out different identities depending on the day. Do you know what the amount is that comes off the top for the School for the Blind and the School for the Deaf?
I have that in a later slide.
Okay, great. Thank you.
So if you have the local revenue for both schools and ESDs, you get the total pot of money available for allocation.
And may I add, given the limitation on our time this morning, we are going to break at 10. Unless it's really burning, let's hold questions to the end, and probably Steve will answer them before you get there. Go ahead.
Okay. All right, once we have that total for schools and ESDs, there's a statutory split, 95.25% go to school districts, 4.75% goes to ESDs. That's been in effect now for a few years, but it was 95% and 5%, but it was changed in the 05 legislature. So once you have that split, then if you subtract out the local revenue for each, you get down to what their share, what the K-12 school district share of the state school fund is, what the ESD share of the state school fund is. The state school fund is about 68% of the total. Property tax is about 30%, and other local revenue, which we'll list later too, the other 2%. All right. Most of this is about the equalization formula. The formula is accused of various things, but it's not about anything like cost reimbursement or entitlement for students or adequacy, stability, what the outcomes have to be, how school districts have to use their inputs, what kind of mix they have to have, what the quality has to be, who's accountable. None of that is in the formula. So just set that aside. It is about defining school district equity, measuring the relative need of districts for funding, given the kinds of students that they have, and certain district characteristics. What's their relative need compared to neighboring school district and every other school district in the state? It reflects the finance issues and court decisions of the 1980s, when the issue then was wealth per student, and trying to make districts that had an equal tax effort in terms of tax rate be able to raise the same amount, or approximately the same amount, per student. And then refining equity by legislative policy over time, and that's occurred since the original formula was adopted. When this was set up in 1991, there were a few distribution principles that they were trying to follow. One was to share all of the school sources statewide, and basically let each district decide how to spend the money that it received, not divide it all up into numerous categorical grants, to adjust for uncontrollable cost differences. Right? If they were controllable, that wasn't as important as those that were uncontrollable in terms of the density of the students in the school district, how far they had to be transported, whether they were special education students, et cetera. Those were considered uncontrollable, so they had to compensate for that. And then try to minimize the incentives to increase district allocations. Design a formula that tried to disallow districts gaming the system to get more money out of it. So they came up with a formula that looked basically like this. The state school fund as the state revenue plus designated local revenue that's in the formula equals the sum of four grants. At the beginning, it was just a general purpose grant and a transportation grant, high cost disability grant, and facility grant have been added after that. And we'll talk about each of those in turn. The state school fund comes from both the general fund and the lottery. The proportions vary from biennium to biennium. It's currently about 89% and 11% out of almost $6 billion for 709, at least it started out that size. May not end up that size. State school fund. Now, these are some of these that are taken off the top. They're dedicated funds or earmarked funds, whatever term you want to use. The small high schools and the state special education, there's your $18.6 million for state special education. Those have been fairly consistent over time in terms of coming off of the top out of the state school fund. Last session, several others were added and for various amounts.
Representative Gels.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So in that state special education, does that include the $18 million for the high-cost disability grant? Or is that
No. That's
just the school for the blind and the school for the deaf?
Mr. Chair, Representative Gelser, I'll get it right this time. That's for the blind, the deaf, and a few others.
But do you know how many students that $18.6 million represents?
I do not.
Could we find out that information, please?
Try to.
Thank you.
But the point is that the list has grown over time, and it will probably be about that much in the governor's budget, at least for the first year, if not the second year of the 09-11 biennium. A local formula revenue, operating property taxes collected, not imposed. Right? So the imposed amount may be more, but not all of it gets collected. It includes the collections for the current year as well as prior years. So eventually it shows up, but what's collected for prior years helps make up for what isn't collected for the current year. Common school fund dollars, that's about $20 million. That has gone down. The assumption is that they will distribute 2% of the common school fund. Before it's been 4 or 5%, so that's been, it will be a substantial drop, especially for next biennium. The county school fund, relatively small amount. Federal force related revenue, that's the secure rural schools money. The state managed federal or county trust force is the Clack Tillamook and Clatsop state force revenue that goes to school districts. And then a little bit of ESD excess local revenue that was intended to be distributed to school districts. And there's a controversy about that, and you'll see legislation dealing with that. The various shares, property taxes being of local revenue, property taxes dominating it at almost 92%, federal force 2.4, common school fund 3.6, and other 2.3. Now, as the federal force, common school fund, and others decrease next biennium, their share of the total will decrease as well. The property tax percent, I expect, will go up for 09-11. And it's about $2.7 billion in the current biennium. All right, so we've talked about state revenue. We've talked about local revenue. Let's now move on to the four grants and talk about those in some detail. The equalization cost factors, what we talked about as uncontrollable cost factors dealt with in the formula are dealt with by student weights, a teacher experience adjustment. Both of those are in the general purpose grant, and then the other three have their own individual grants. The facility grant equals up to 8% of construction costs, but there's a limit of $25 million per biennium, not per year, per biennium, for that 8% of construction costs. the facility grant cannot be used for construction is to help fund equipment and other furnishings that can't be bonded. So it was in response to the changes in bonding authority that passed.
As a part of Measure 50.
Measure 47 initially and then
right.
Incorporated into 50, yes. And it's paid in the school year that the facility is first used. Construction costs do not include land costs, but it can include costs for infrastructure to make the building usable. It applies to portables and additions as well as whole new school buildings. The high-cost disability grant, again, equals up to the sum of eligible costs above $30,000 per disability student. All right, so the costs have to be more than $30,000 before they're included. The grant is limited to $18 million per year. And so when it exceeds $18 million, which it does, it has to be prorated down, just like the facility grants are prorated down because of the $25 million limit per biennium. The high-cost disability grant does include ESD costs for those students. So the district basically gets the regular student weight, the extra weight for a disability student. Let's say that that's 6,000, 6,000, 12,000. Then that 12,000 to the 30,000 is not included in the formula, and then everything above that 30,000 becomes included as part of the high-cost disability grant.
Except for the prorate amount, of course. Representative Gelser.
Thank you. So if you have a student with a high-cost disability in a district and the services are primarily provided by the ESD, it's still the school district that gets the benefit of the reimbursement?
Mr. Chair, Representative Gelser, yes, the school district would be claiming as part of their grant. Okay, any other questions on those two grants?
I understand it.
Okay. Transportation grant equals 70 to 90% of approved transportation costs. The districts are ranked by transportation costs per student from high to low. The top 10% of the districts have 90% of their costs included in the formula, the next 10% at 80%, and then the bottom 80% stayed at 70%. The differentiation there is because some districts have very high costs per student, maybe over $1,000. And so if everybody was treated at 70%, their 30% would represent much more per student. And so this change was made to help compensate for that.
We're talking primarily about very large school districts, physically large school districts with small populations, aren't we?
Yes, we are.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're small school districts for the very low density, long distances to school, busing costs.
A number of them are probably in District 60.
Most of them.
Yeah, most of them.
All right, approved costs, basically transporting students that live 1 mile away or more from school if they're elementary school students, and 1.5 miles if they're secondary students, and some other uses related to education, and if not transported, if they live on the campus, then room and board in lieu of transportation. Costs have increased over time. This gives you the comparison between what's included in the formula, the 70%, and what isn't. General purpose grant. This is the most complex one because it has weighted students times $4,500 adjusted by teacher experience, and then that balanced to total available funds. And we'll deal with each of these components in turn. Students are measured different ways. Right? The formula uses ADM, average daily membership, with kindergarten at half weight. ADMW being weighted ADM, okay. And then extended ADMW, which is the weighted student count, being the higher of the current year or the prior year. Whenever we talk about ADMW, well, we'll say ADMW. We won't say extended ADMW. Most of the time, if we say ADMW, we're really talking about extended ADMW because that's what's used in the formula. What complicates this, too, is that there's other measures used when you're talking about dollars per student, whether you're talking about dollars per enrolled student, dollars per average daily membership student, dollars per average daily attendance. Makes it confusing in terms of what you're really trying to measure. Okay, the student weights vary depending on the type of student. If it's an individual education program for special education students, they have one regular weight, one extra weight for a total of two in the formula. Poverty students have an extra quarter weight for a total of 1.25, and so on. English as a second language, extra half weight for a total of 1.5, and then the other categories.
Do you talk later about why these weights are important?
Yes, I will, Mr. Chair.
All right, thank you.
If I don't, remind me, please.
Well, I mean, the whole thing fits together in a trunk, and if you don't understand that, then all these formulas don't make any sense.
Yes.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Gelser.
Can I ask a question about the weighting? If a student has more than one of these characteristics, so for instance, it's an ESL student that has a disability that lives in a foster home, does it max out at two, or is there a pile-on effect for the characteristics?
Mr. Chair, Representative Gelser, there is a maximum of two, but the language doesn't cover all of the weights. So it's not possible, in my reading of the statute, to exceed the extra two.
Okay. Thank you.
The reason is that some of these, like students in poverty, it's not a student. The school district isn't identifying each student that's in poverty. It's using a census number, or it's getting a report from human resources in terms of number of students in your district that qualify for this weight. Mm-hmm. The IEP, one extra weight, it's about 13.3% of students, but this is one of the limits that applies. Districts can't claim more than 11% of their students as IEP students without a waiver, even though the number they have exceeds 11%. 33 districts currently are below the 11%. The other 156 are above the 11%. Okay. The waivers cover about 4,600 students, so that you end up with about 89% of the IEP students having a wait, okay, just because of the waiver process. There was legislation last year to increase the 11% to about 13%. 11% when back in 91 when this was set up was about the state average. The state average now is closer to 13%, but we're still have 11% in the statute.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Gelser.
Sorry, I like education. On your last bullet that you didn't talk about, it says that half of the districts report that their IEP costs are less than the revenue they receive. Is that accurate, that we are providing more funding to school districts to provide special education services than what it's costing school districts to provide special education services?
Mr. Chair, Representative Gelser, this is based upon some work I did in the 05 interim. Mm-hmm. And if you include federal dollars and ESD dollars in the picture, yes.
Mr. Chair, that's astounding. I think that generally there's the perception that special education swamps the cost of general education, not that special education becomes a revenue source for school districts. I'd be interested in learning more about that work.
Remember also that each local school district determines its own budget and how its budget is going to be spent. If you were to talk, and I know you do, to parents of IEP students, you'll know that many of them believe that the school district is underfunding their education program for IEP students. So I think you hear both sets of things.
I think you hear both sets. I think what I tend to hear in the response that's given to parents is we aren't adequately funded to provide IEP services. But if, in fact, districts are receiving more than they're spending, parents perhaps have a very good argument that if the federal law isn't being met to provide FAPE and there's more money than what is being spent, that would be a very significant policy issue for the state to look at in terms of the provision of a free and appropriate public education to these kids.
And without extending the conversation too long, let me just add that would be a wonderful argument if the one-weighted student, if we had enough funds to actually educate the one-weighted student at the quality education model level, then I think that argument becomes particularly powerful. Until then, we're dealing with school boards that are struggling to try to divide up the funds in order to give every student the best education they can with the money they've got. Otherwise, I think your point is absolutely right on. Find the extra $2 billion or so that it takes to get us to the QEM, and this argument should disappear, I hope.
True. And Mr. Chair, just to push back, I think that argument would be true if it was equal. But if the state is allocating money for special ed and it's being spent on other things and we then blame special education students for the problems in our school districts, there's an issue.
You're raising a different point than I thought you were. Thank you. Why don't we go ahead with this and we'll continue this discussion another time.
Mr. Chair, just a reminder, the distribution of special education students is very uneven from district to district. Small districts may have special education students that aren't very expensive. Larger districts may have the more expensive ones. Consequently, you have this kind of result.
Well, families with very expensive students tend to locate themselves based on where services are available to them, don't they?
Yes.
And I would assume that means we're talking that parents of students who live in rural areas, students with very special and expensive needs may decide that it makes sense for them to move into a city where those services are available, hence this waiting. Is that a reasonable kind of assumption?
Yes.
I mean, if I were a parent in that situation, I would be making decisions based on my child's needs rather than my own comfort or my occupational situation.
Yes. English as a second language, an extra one-half weight. Out of the 197 districts, 128 report ESL students. They're about 10% of ADM. And again, using another report, there were only 12 districts that reported costs more than weight revenue. So if you want to talk about there being a discrepancy between what's expended and the weight revenue, ESL is probably overfunding more than the IEP situation. So the extra weight revenue in that study was about $2,600 per ESL student. So the data would tend to argue, well, one of the problems with ESL is that it's probably hard to track what those costs are, so there's probably under-reporting. But we don't know how much that might be. With IEP, it's probably easier to track, and so that's probably more accurate. But you could argue that one half might be too much, and in general, one might not be enough for IEP. This gives you an idea of the number of students in each of the categories, about 70,000 special education, poverty, getting approaching over 80,000. And pregnant and parenting, very small number, and neglected and delinquent, very small number. There are some other weights not related to special education, kindergarten being at half. There are a few elementary districts where the weight is 90, or 0.9, excuse me, for elementary districts, and the high school students get a weight of 1.2. And then you have the elementary, small elementary, and high schools, and that varies. And we'll get to that. Small high school qualification. You have to be in a district less than 8,500 ADMW. The location can have changed for some time. It has to have been a small high school in 1999, and the number of students for four grades has to be less than 350. For a small elementary school qualification for extra weight, again, it has to be have been a remote small school in 1995, no change in location, and have fewer than 224 students for eight grades, and fewer ADM if there's fewer than eight grades in the school. Then this has a distance requirement, has to be at least 8 miles to the nearest other elementary school. The mileage requirement for high schools was removed. There used to be one, and that was had to be over 10 miles, I believe it was, yes. How much is the extra weight? Well, it depends upon the ADM involved and the number of grades. This gives you an idea. For a four-grade high school that is at about 175 students, it adds about 89 student weights in the formula. As it grows toward the maximum 350 to qualify, the extra weight tapers down to zero. Okay. Same for the other examples in that chart. Okay, just a couple of charts give you an idea of the student counts, how they have changed over time. Won't dwell on that. The growth has been fairly regular. The idea here is that the extended is about 20 or 25% higher. Excuse me, the weighted extended is about 20 or 25% higher than just the ADM number. Teacher experience adjustment in the general purpose grant. You have a state average experience level in terms of number of years of teacher experience, and you have a district average. You look at that difference. For some districts, that's below the state average. It's going to be negative. For those that are above the state average, it's going to be positive, times $25. Okay. And then that $25 is adjusted for that difference. In the example, the district has two more years above the state average, so it gets an extra $50 per student. Okay. If the district is below average, in the second example, 1 year below the average, it loses $25 per student. The pluses and minuses about balance out. When this was started, one of the reasons to put it in the formula is that some of these districts had more experienced staff, that they had to pay more, and so they felt disadvantaged in the formula if there wasn't something to take that into effect. They couldn't readjust their experience level right away when the formula started. So now they've had 15 years to do it, but it's still here. But the $25 hasn't been changed either, so it doesn't have a major impact.
Yes.
Very brief. Doesn't that seem to be a problem in that the schools with less experience level are stuck with a lesser experience level by not having enough money to raise their experience level? It seems to me, you know, we're giving the schools more money that already have experienced teachers, so the ones without experienced teachers can't hire more experienced teachers. They don't have the money.
Representative Riley, it's a very interesting point. I think when we get into a general discussion of this issue, if we do, it would be very useful to have that that conversation. I think one of the things to be aware of as we deal with this, and I don't want to spend very much time on it, but simply to note that these things tend to cross-cut against each other over time. And the other thing on this particular issue is that there's generational change. As teachers retire, then you don't tend to hire another experienced teacher. You hire a much less experienced teacher at a lower pay rate, and all of a sudden your experience adjustment changes. So I don't know how effective that is for over the long haul. Representative Gelser.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just as a clarification, it seems like when I was on a school board, that got calculated at the end of the year that it was factored against. So from year to year, it would change. So that generational factor, it would drop. So it didn't drive who we could hire, but rather who we hired compared to other people in the state drove how that reimbursement came back in. Am I remembering that correctly?
Mr. Chair, Representative Gelser, I think, I'm not sure whether it's current year or prior year that's used in this calculation.
But it does change regularly.
It does change from year to year, yes. The state average has dropped a little bit as younger teachers are being hired. Okay, so the general purpose grant then equals, going back to what we saw earlier, ADMW extended times the $4,500 target, adjusted for teacher experience, up or down that target by that $25 per year, and then times a balance ratio. The $4,500 target was set in 91. It was something to strive towards that funding level. They were below it at the time. So at that time, the balance ratio then, which makes the sum of the four grants equal the state dollars plus the local dollars in the formula, was less than one. Okay. That balance ratio now is over 1.3, just because the target $4,500 isn't as realistic anymore as it was.
So the balance ratio is going to include inflation.
Yes.
As well as other factors in it.
Correct.
Right. Thank you.
The growth in the state school fund.
Right.
Okay.
I mean, that's a derives number, isn't it? Once you calculate all these numbers, not counting the balance ratio, you add them up,
yes.
You compare it to the school fund, and the ratio between those two is the balance ratio.
School fund and local revenue, yes.
Yes. The total revenues available versus the first three factors establishes the balance ratio, which then used to calculate each school district's allotment.
Correct.
Right. All right.
The balance ratio will make the general purpose grant size such that the four add up to available funds.
Right. Thank you. I didn't say that very well, but I appreciate the way you said it. Thanks.
Okay. Now, this is just substituting a little bit detail for each of the grants in the equalization formula. So the big box at the bottom, you have the general purpose grant up in the upper left-hand corner, the transportation grant upper right-hand corner, the high-cost disability lower left, and the transportation grant lower right. Now, what I wanted to do, and I hope you'll bear with me, even though time is short, is to play a what-if game with the formula to test our understanding of how these interplay with each other. For example, if voters pass a slew of new bonds and schools start constructing new buildings, what happens in terms of the facility grant? Are all districts affected by that? I guess is the point I want to get across. Right? And the answer is no.
It's capped.
Because of the cap.
Okay.
So what happens is that the available construction grant dollars get reallocated among the districts that qualify with new facility construction. Okay. So limited number of districts that are affected. Same way with high-cost disability grant. Because of the cap, if those costs are going up in some districts more than in others, it's just rearranging the funds for the districts that qualify for a high-cost disability grant. Okay. Transportation costs. By the way, we talked about the 70 to 90% being in the formula. Where's the other 30% or so come from? Assuming that the school district, let's assume that the formula revenue is all of the revenue that the school district has. 70% for most districts is included in the formula. The other 30% isn't.
Comes from the rest of the money.
It comes basically out of the general purpose grant money. Okay, so there's a trade-off there. When the transportation grant goes up, if there's no change in state and local revenue amounts, the general purpose grant dollars per student decreases. Okay. The other point I want to make on that is how much of the transportation dollars in the formula are state dollars and how much are local dollars? Does it make a difference? The statutes don't say how much of any of the grants are state dollars, how much are local dollars. We often hear the comment that 70% of the transportation costs are paid with state dollars. Not necessarily the case. It may vary. I like to think of each of the grants having the same proportion of state and local revenue as they have, and apply that to each of the grants. But you can say that all of the transportation, 70% is state dollars, but then that means more local dollars are in the general purpose grant or somewhere else. And just understand that it's not in statute in terms of what those shares are for each of the grants.
And, of course, that varies from district to district, which, and I think based primarily on the different value of property, assessed value of property in each district per student. Some districts have a lot of assessed value per student, and other districts don't have as much.
Correct.
And so in the districts that are relatively more wealthy, there are fewer state revenue dollars and more local revenue dollars, and vice versa, in order to reach that equalization that we talked about earlier.
Mr. Chair, that's correct.
It is just about 10 o'clock. I don't know whether this is a good place to break.
It's a very good place to break.
Dr. Warner and I were discussing when we could continue this, and it looks as though we'll have time to continue this discussion on Friday. So we'll...
Start meeting tomorrow.
I'm sorry?
What do we have tomorrow?
We have other things already scheduled for tomorrow, but it looks like we may have a little bit more time on Friday, and we're sitting over here rejiggering our schedule in order to make this fit. We're taking a little more time on these information meetings than we had originally planned, but I think it's really important for the committee to understand the overview of our total revenue school situation and school funding formula situation as we get on into dealing with bills. And unless there's something else for the good of the order today, I don't see anything. We'll meet again tomorrow morning, bright and early at 8 o'clock, and the Revenue Committee is adjourned.
Can I just have a moment of your time?
Yeah.
That thing that he held up. John held up.
Thank you.